The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
Come into the circle of love and justice. Come into the community of mercy, holiness, and health. Come, and you shall know peace and joy. Good morning and welcome to Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. I am Reverend Andrew Weber, always happily nervous to be leading a group of ministers in worship. And I say ministers because you all, we all do the theology. We all do the application. We all do the challenge, and we all do the support of ministry. We are in this together. We are in this together. Unitarian Universalism is faith put into action, where we take our beliefs about life and we put those beliefs into action in our lives. This month especially, we're looking at being vulnerable, opening up, connecting with those most tender parts of ourselves and others. We will try to live with care. We will try to live into being vulnerable. We will fail. And we will try again. So welcome. Welcome to all of you who have come with vulnerability, bringing your entire, your true selves to this community. Welcome to those of you here in person and those of you joining us through the miracle of technology. Today, I'm especially honored to be joined in leading worship by Brooke Shockley and Judy Moll, who will embody with me the theme of vulnerability. So Judy, please lead us in our chalice lighting.
Chalice lighting. Reading by Leos T. Okay, I'll read the first line and please join me. If there is to be peace in the world,
there must be peace in the nations.
If there is to be peace in the nations,
there must be peace in the cities.
If there is to be peace in the cities,
there must be peace between neighbors.
If there is to be peace between neighbors,
there must be peace in the home.
If there is to be peace in the home,
there must be peace in the heart.
Now, we'll lighting of the peace lamp. May peace be with you.
With all the people of the world.
Thank you.
Please rise now in spirit or in body and join in our opening song, Step by Step, The Longest March.
I would like to invite all the kiddos up because I want to read What Do You Do With a Problem? And this is written by Kobe Yamada and illustrated by Mae Bassoon. All right. Hey, guys. What do you do with a problem? I don't know how it happened, but one day I had a problem. I didn't want it. I didn't ask for it. I really didn't like having a problem, but it was there. Why is it here? What does it want? What do you do with a problem? I thought. I wanted to make it go away. I shooed it. I scowled at it. I tried ignoring it, but nothing worked. I started to worry about my problem. What if it swallows me up? What if my problem sneaks up and gets me? What if it takes away all of my things? I worried a lot. I worried about what would happen. I worried about what could happen. I worried about this, and I worried about that. And the more I worried, the bigger my problem became. I wished it would just disappear. I tried everything I could to hide from it. I even found ways to disguise myself, but it still found me. And the more I avoided my problem, the more I saw it everywhere. I thought about it all the time, and I didn't feel good at all. Oh. I couldn't take it anymore. This has to stop, I declared. Maybe I was making my problem bigger and scarier than it actually was. After all, my problem hadn't really swallowed me up or attacked me. I realized that I had to face it. So, even though I didn't want to, even though I was really afraid, I got ready and I tackled my problem. And when I got face to face with it, I discovered something. My problem wasn't what I thought it was. I discovered it had something beautiful inside. My problem held an opportunity. It was an opportunity for me to learn and grow, to be brave, to do something. It showed me that I was important. It was important to look closely to some opportunities because they only come once. So now I see problems differently. I'm not afraid of them anymore because I know their secret. Every problem has an opportunity for something good. You just have to look for it. Wow. What are problems for? They challenge us, they shape us, push us, and help us to discover just how strong and brave and capable we really are. Even though we don't always want them, problems have a way of changing us in unexpected ways. So what will you do with your problem? Now that's up to you. Have you guys ever had a problem that you were scared of? Yeah? And what did you do about your problem? Yeah, face it. Talk to somebody about it, maybe. What about Roland? Did you words? Sometimes problems are really scary. And remember when we read the book Enemy Pie, when he faced his problem and ended up making a friend later? So maybe that was like the secret and the solution, right? All right, well, thanks, guys. Thanks for reading with me. Thank you.
Thank you, Brooke. We have stories, songs, reflections today, all about a difficult topic. And our reading today is from the book Restored to Sanity, Essays on the 12 Steps by Unitarian Universalists. It's a collection of essays from Unitarian Universalists who are living in recovery. They're all heartfelt and moving, and I recommend this book to all of you. I usually give away my copy, so I just ordered 10 more this morning. And so if you're intrigued, come back to me in 4 to 6 weeks or however long it takes, and I'll help you out. Here are these words by Kent. Religion, philosophy, and recovery all raise important questions about power. In this precious, crazy, beautiful, worrisome world, who has the power? Who or what makes things happen and how? Because of life's pervasive lack of fairness, I have always felt an aversion to theologies that claim that God is in charge of everything. I've heard it said more than once in the rooms of AA that, quote, God controls all. We can't understand why some things happen. God has a larger plan in which we should trust. Viewing the world suffering, I could never agree. God didn't cause all these problems. Human beings deserve much of the blame. Similar objections cause many Unitarian Universalists to struggle with the third step, that is, made a decision to turn our wills and our lives over to the care of God as we understand him. Kent goes on, I had a good AA friend who taught me about a core element of the third step when he said, often, that the only thing you have to know about God is that you are not God. I felt like I was buried in an avalanche of pain, and I didn't know if any rescue teams would be able to find me. I knew I wasn't God. This third step encouraged me to look, to reflect on my beliefs and on that to which I dedicated myself. I came to believe that God is love and love is God. I believe that there are divine energies of love, courage, and hope in this world that are infinitely greater than I. As a Unitarian Universalist, I draw upon the rich tapestry of theology that helps us to understand our human relationship with divine mystery and to engage in collaborative efforts to fortify justice. We never have to settle for the concept of a separate God who operates over and above us. So what does it mean to turn our lives over to the care of God or light, love, joy, nature? Nature itself is indifferent to human beings. Bad things happen to good people all the time. Many of us have wondered why we should risk turning ourselves over to a chaotic, unfair universe. I have come to believe that there is a gracious goodness in AA groups, the church, the community, and the world. If we open ourselves up or plug ourselves in, we can benefit greatly. When I pray, count my blessings, celebrate life, and help others, I gain strength. On the other hand, when I seek revenge, lament my loss, only look inward and sulk, I become weaker. Counterintuitively, when I open my heart and turn myself over to the world, I am stronger than if I just rely on self-sufficiency. Thank you, Kent. Addiction is a very personal and very difficult topic. And as we enter into this dialogue, some very strong feelings may arise. And that's okay, and that's good. I encourage anyone who feels the need for further time, for further reflection, to join Judy, Brooke, and I in my office down the hallway. If you want to talk to us together, if you want to grab one of us, or if you want to reach out later this week or later this month or year, please do that. Reach out. And we also have a whole bunch of resources on the, not the welcome table, but the other table out in the foyer. And if you're online, you can always email me or send something to the crew and we will get in touch. This is a tough topic. It's a tough topic. Addictions come in many, many different forms. And almost all of them are culturally taboo to speak of. The most commonly held addiction is to drugs or alcohol, but there's also codependence, over or under eating, sex, gambling, a myriad of addictions around media and new social technologies, to name just a few. And even though our culture may not discuss these topics of addiction, they are not small in their impact of the world. And to help us understand the impact of addictions, I'm going to do a quick exercise with us. And this, I'm asking you to be a little vulnerable, so please enter as you feel comfortable. Will you please raise your hand if you or someone you know is dealing with an addiction? That's a fair number. Now, would everyone please raise your hand? Thank you. Because you're all connected to me. And I have an ongoing addictive relationship with food. Starting in high school, I developed a problem with my self-image that was so impairing that it led to an eating disorder. And although it has been many years since I engaged in the destructive habits and behaviors, I still live with those daily thoughts and those ideas of addiction to food. It's not an easy topic to share publicly, but it's important to share. It's very important to share. First of all, is that I'm really big. You may hear this a lot. I'm really big on embodied religion. Like, what's your faith? Okay, great. Now live it. Show me. I'm really big on embodied religion. My faith has to inform how I live. It has to inform what I'm doing. So if I'm going to talk about vulnerability, well, I'm going to be vulnerable. That's what my faith tells me. My faith tells me to enter into that difficult, that holy space. I preach also that we're a caring and supportive community which welcomes with open arms people who bring their full selves. So we must bring our full selves, which means not just what we want people to see, our full selves. We are called to be our full, true, aired selves, and we're called to treat each other with love, knowing that we want them also to bring their full, true, aired selves. So it's not just me who can stand up here and say I'm living with an addiction. Today is not just an intellectual exercise. We're going for real, for tangible experiences. And this is why I say addiction is a great equalizer. It is a great equalizer. Not great in good, great in broad. You want to see a diverse gathering? Don't go to a church. Go to an AA meeting. If you want to see a diverse gathering, addiction doesn't just affect one race, one socioeconomic class, one gender, one education level, one geographical area. Addiction comes in many forms, and it spans across our human differences to touch everyone. We have people who are actively engaged in recovering from addictions here, I am sure, and in all parts of our lives. Be it alcohol, food, sex, gambling, drugs, there are addicts in our midst. And yes, that's the question now. The question now, because we never know who is specifically dealing with an addiction, dealing in recovery, or dealing not yet in recovery. The question is, how do we treat people we interact with? How do we treat ourselves, knowing that? How do we live our mission and our values as Unitarian Universalists? How do we reach out to another and to ourselves with love and care? And as we spend some more time with addictions, I just want to remind us that as our individual lives are so different, so are our experiences. And Brooke and Judy and I can only speak about our experiences. We can only speak about what we know from our understandings. Living with an addiction is extremely difficult and is a lifelong process. This is where the language that we use, we speak of being active in addiction or being in recovery or being sober. Very few talk about being over or being done with an addiction. You don't check a mark and be done. Because there's no time when you're done. You speak of how many years or decades you've been in recovery. It doesn't go away. And it's how many years we've lived without the demeaning or unhealthy actions of our addiction. How long have you been living with your addiction, but not acting on those self-destroying urges? This is being in recovery. And that's the goal of most people with addictions, learning to live life without being controlled by an unhealthy substance or action. So what I'm saying is, addiction is universal. That's my goal here. And not that every single person is either living in recovery or active usage, but that every single person is touched by addiction. You may not know it, but every single day you interact with addicts. Oh, that's a hard label to hold on to, addict, right? There's a lot of baggage. An addict is someone who is a compulsion or a need for a habit-forming substance, activity, or behavior. A compulsion which impacts different areas of their life. Okay, that fits. Yeah, I guess. So come to church. You have a minister living in addiction. Go to school, your family, meet your friends, people who you pass driving the supermarket. Yeah, addicts, guaranteed. It's hard to get factual, precise numbers since anonymity is the norm for many groups and outside of the groups. Either a healthy anonymity of healing or the unhealthy anonymity of hiding. But for now, I leave you with this realization that addiction impacts more people and more of your loved ones than you might initially think. Let us live with that knowledge. Let us live with that and let us inform how we act and how we live our lives and how we live our faith. And hopefully that knowledge will allow more space for personal vulnerability and more space for loving those who bring their own vulnerability. So let us now listen to some music and reflect on those. Amen.
At 17, I started to starve myself. I thought that love was a kind of emptiness. And at least I understood then the hunger I felt. And I didn't have to call it loneliness. We all have a hunger. We all have a hunger. Tell me what you need.
very nervous. When at AA meetings, many people, most people can share without reading their story, but I have the excuse I'm 80 years old and, you know, memory lapses and whatnot. Plus, I have my story. It happened to have been written in AA. I sent it to the Grapevine, which is AA's meeting in print, and they come out every month. And a couple of years ago, I sent mine in. So they did publish it. And ironically, the timing is very interesting because the title of my story is She Made the Shot. And it says she left basketball behind for the drinking game, but eventually scored a win. Such timeliness, since the women's basketball is making TV now. It's amazing. Okay, so I hope you forgive me. I'm going to read my story. I wrote it, my story, and show you how. I want to mention before I start reading is that alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful. I mean, you do not have any idea. I mean, when you least suspect it, you could take a drink without realizing it. And I've had a lot of years. And anyway, I'll read my story so I don't ramble. I grew up in the small Massachusetts town of Lunenburg. My high school graduating class in 1960 had just 76 students. My family consisted of my brother and I and my mother and father. I was a very quiet, shy, tall tomboy who loved playing basketball. Once I got to junior high, I played basketball all the time. My mother was overprotective and tried unsuccessfully to make a lady of me. We moved to another school district when I was in seventh grade, and I had a miserable time trying to fit in. I was picked on and bullied because I never fought back. But my escape was playing basketball. I loved gym because I would always be picked first when we played. In high school, I managed to become friends with the quiet, studious girls. Unfortunately, they didn't play basketball. I had to endure the isolation of not being in the social clique that played sports. But I excelled in high school and was on the girls' basketball team. I was high scorer consistently my first year and even had a left-handed hook shot and jump shot, which was unheard of for girls way back in the day. In my sophomore year, though, unfortunately, our team got a new coach who took a dislike to me, and I was dropped to last string. The coach only let me play the last few minutes of every game. I endured 2 years of being a third string player, but I showed up at every practice and still loved playing. I was always practicing, even in the hot heat of the summer, at the basketball backyard in my backboard in my backyard. But in my senior year, we got a new coach, and I was on first string in every game. We won that year's championship. I mean, it's like a movie. We won that year's championship, and I was given the coveted Best Athlete Award at the end of the year. Then I went on to college. It was 1960, and I went to a religious liberal arts school, and there was no intercollegiate girls basketball. I was homesick for a few weeks, but I was away from my overprotective, controlling mother, and on my own. I was introduced to beer at fraternity parties, and at first I drank with shame and guilt. I didn't drink excessively until my junior year. Every weekend, my roommates and I would walk the 20 minutes to town to the bars. Then in my junior year, also my father died. I was devastated and didn't have a way to show or deal with my grief. That summer, I went to summer school. My roommate Sarah had a car, and we drank every night. I remember getting very drunk very often, but we still made it to class. My boyfriend Paul would drive to town from 50 miles away to see me every Saturday night. When he was around, I would be controlled and just have one drink, and I did not smoke cigarettes. During a week in the dorm, I smoked and drank. I was a good girl. When Paul came, he came from Tri-State College in Indiana, and we'd go out on a date, and I would just have one drink, and then that was it. And I didn't know anything about sex, so that was not a problem. And then my senior year at school was difficult. My drinking increased. I barely passed my classes. I had no realization that I had never really grieved for my father. I would just start crying when I was trying to study. I wonder why. I had no comprehension about the void in my heart from his death. But then in November, President Kennedy was shot, and the whole world grieved, and so did I. The assassination served as an opportunity for me to grieve for my father. Though I didn't know at the time that's what I was doing. I had no comprehension of grief. My drinking progressed. I was engaged now and would be getting married after I graduated, because that is what my mother wanted. Back then, this is 1964 or 63, I graduated in 64. That is what girls did. We were programmed to go to college and to find a husband. I figured I'd stop drinking when I left school and become a housewife. My wedding was just 2 weeks after graduation. I stopped drinking, but I felt totally isolated. I was living with a husband I didn't know. I was just 21 years old. But who could feel sorry for me? I was living in the suburbs in a brand new house with a brand new car and new furniture, but I missed my old college friends. My husband, Paul, was an electrical engineer. He was a humorless, serious man who had a good work ethic, but definitely wasn't any fun to be with. I married him. Sorry about that, electrical. I married him because he fit the qualifications for a husband. I don't know where I found that qualification list. Anyway, probably my mother. I believed he loved me, but I hate to say this, I just liked him. I was in love with love, not him. So after a long summer of feeling lost, I got a teaching job for teaching first grade. I went back to college for teaching credits and finally met up with some drinkers who drank like I did. I worked as a teacher for 3 years before I quit to have my first child as planned. Over the next 4 years, I monitored my drinking. I didn't drink when I was pregnant because I knew it wasn't good for the baby. I had two healthy girls who have made me very proud. They were adorable, if I do say so myself, and are still beautiful. By year 7 of our marriage, things were getting stressful. I was functional, but drinking martinis every afternoon with my next door neighbor, and then drinking again after we made supper, sometimes half conscious, but we did make supper, and then my next door neighbor, I'd go over and drink with her some more, and then Paul would come home and I'd go to bed, and then I'd get up and have another drink in the middle of the night. Anyway, my drinking did increase a lot, although I was always a functional alcoholic. My girls were 10 and 12 when Paul and I split. So in 1977, now having been a housewife for 10 years, I went back to work to the best paying job I could find. Guess what it was? Driving the school bus. I wouldn't drink until I got home from the last run in the afternoon, so rest assured, parents, I didn't drive drunk, sort of, but not really. Then I would go out at night. My poor girls never knew when I was coming home. They dumped my vodka down the drain more than once, but I'd just get annoyed and go out and buy more. After my divorce, in 1977, I lived a sort of fractured life. During the week, my daughters were with me, and on weekends, they were with their father. So I would party all weekend and holidays, every weekend. I traveled to gay bars in Atlantic City, Harrisburg, and Allentown. Usually, I would spend the weekend with someone I'd meet. It was a desperate existence. I almost gave my girls up because the woman in Harrisburg I was involved with didn't like children. And if you've ever seen way back when, there was a movie called Looking for Mr. Goodbar, and with Diane Keaton back in the day. And that was my life, actually, except fortunately I didn't get killed like she did at the end of the movie. Eventually, I took a weekend job at Chit Chat in the medical records department. And then I drove school bus in the morning and in the afternoon, and in between 10 and 2, I'd go to Chit Chat. Little did I know Chit Chat was a rehab. I had not a clue. Didn't know anything about alcoholism. But the woman who I worked for at Chit Chat figured out, I don't know how, that I was an alcoholic. And her boss and her were both in recovery. So I figure I might have reeked a little bit of having come in late, you know, like Wednesday night especially, staying out all hours, having drank and gone to discos and stayed out all hours. Anyway, they took me aside and they fired me. So how could they do that? So, but that's when I finally found my way to AA. When I came in, I was emotionally and spiritually bankrupt. I was also afraid, after not having a drink for 4 days, that I'd start again, because I was a daily drinker. So I followed many of the suggestions given to me. It's now been 43 years since I've had a drink. I still go to several meetings a week, and I'm active in my home group. My partner, now wife, Helen, and I have been together for 30 years. We have many friends in AA and get involved in activities. All our adult children, hers and mine, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, accept our lifestyle. We both work the program to the best of our ability, and today we are so grateful for the sober life we have together. And that's, thank you.
If you feel so moved, I invite you now to come forward and share into the microphone a joy or a sorrow. And if you're online, you can wave your actual or virtual hand by pushing the button, and we will get you. And please start with your name.
We will bring this time of sharing to a close by singing Spirit of Life. The words will appear here on screen momentarily, and it'll be performed by our very own Christine Perry.
Spirit of life, come unto me, sing in my heart all the stirrings of compassion, blow in the wind, rise in the sea.
I'd like to end our time of sharing with a prayer, and I was thinking, what do I pray? What do I have? Extemporaneous? Do I compose? Do I pick something? And I thought, why not just keep it simple and use the prayer, which is shared at many, many, if not every AA meeting. So if you wish, you may speak this with me. If you don't wish, that is okay. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen.
Hi, I'm Brooke. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. And it's kind of funny to say that here, but it's very natural for me because that's how I qualify myself. And it's sometimes it's hard not to say it when I introduce myself. So it's nice to be able to actually, you know, admit that. But at one point in my life, it was actually very hard for me to say that, those words. And it's like I was talking to my husband about this the other night. When I have a problem, it likes to live in the dark, like a secret. And in the dark, it grows and thrives and breathes. But when I bring it to the light and talk about it, it dies. And I felt like saying, I'm Brooke, I'm an alcoholic, would be the end, because it would be admitting defeat over alcohol. And then the party would be over and everybody would be right. So so it was very hard for me to come to that, and I wanted to talk about vulnerability and Alcoholics Anonymous and the first two steps. So the first step being we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable. And for me, the unmanageability was apparent from the beginning. I really started drinking hard in high school, but I had had some drinks at family get-togethers before that, and it would be very supervised. My mom would be like, okay, that's enough, you know, and it would be over. But when I met a friend that was just as socially awkward and in the same emotional pain that I was in high school, and we started experimenting with alcohol, we quickly progressed to drinking every day. And for me, it was every morning before school, and then after school, and then during school. And then school, I couldn't go anymore. You know, it actually was interfering too much with my drinking. So I dropped out and quickly lost everything. I do remember my mom saying, you know, she thought that if you let a bottle of alcohol sit for too long, it would evaporate. And there's my disease going, yes, you know, like she doesn't know, we're okay, we can keep going, nothing's wrong, you know. And, you know, at a point she realized that there was something wrong. And she said to me, you know, I think you're an alcoholic. My dad was an alcoholic and he actually died from this disease. So I lost my father as well. But I was like, what are you talking about? That's not my image of an alcoholic. I'm not a man. I'm not sitting under a bridge with a brown bottle, you know, like bag drinking, you know, I'm young, I'm having fun. And eventually it came to her saying, you know, you can't live here anymore if you continue to drink like this. And I heard, okay, so you're kicking me out. But all she wanted me to do was stop drinking, and I couldn't. And I just spiraled out of control from there. And after a long, long road of painful events in my life, I ended up at an AA meeting. And my husband was the one to take me there. He kind of saw that before I did. But I was in this meeting and still socially awkward and in a lot of pain. And I saw this woman who had this light about her, and she was, you know, in a room full of people just laughing and free and like just totally natural. And I could only look at my feet. So I went up to her and asked if I could just talk to her about my problems. And she invited me into her home, and I thought, you want me, like this terrible person, like over at your house? Wow. You know, but she started going through the book of Alcoholics Anonymous with me and brought me to the second step, which is came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I was not raised in a religious household. I didn't know anything about God. And in fact, it really scared me because I had no knowledge of the subject. So she said, well, do you believe that I believe? And with the like her story and background matching mine so well and the way that she was today, I said, yeah. And she said to me, Brooke, you're standing at a door and looking through a keyhole, and on the other side of the door is this bright light, and I'm going to teach you how to access that light. And, you know, she didn't say it had to be the God that I was afraid of, the one that had been punishing me, that I resented for taking the life of my father. You know, like, I had all these judgments. But she said it could be anything greater than myself, you know, as long as I wasn't making the decisions anymore, which is a very good thing. She's like, are you driving the bus or is God driving the bus? And it could be the spirit of the universe or whatever makes you feel connected. And just giving over that self-will really greatly made me grow. And I have to do it every day. And I'm still learning and I'm still growing. And I really appreciate you guys listening to me and all the support that I have. Thank you.
They tried to make me go to rehab, I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no, no, no. I ain't got the time, and if my daddy thinks I'm fine, they tried to make me go to rehab, I won't go, go.
If you would please rise in spirit or body and join in our closing song, Love Will Guide Us. These flames, but not the hope and faith that they symbolize. So may the lights we end here continue to live on in our minds, in our hearts, and in our souls. And if you would please join me in our unison closing words. Take courage, friends. The way is often hard, the path is never clear, and the stakes are very high. Take courage, for deep down there is another truth. You are not alone. Amen, and blessed be.